This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Here we are after another week. The world continues to turn. Important events keep cascading. In these fascinating times, we have some members of the Trumpet writing staff. We've been scouring the headlines all week, and we're here to help you make sense of the events that are happening in this world. We have in the studio here Robert Morley.
Good to be here today. We'll talk about the demise of Britain's steel industry and why it is letting it die to buy friendship with China.
We also have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'll be discussing some sobering signs of sharply rising authoritarianism in China.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. I'll be talking about nuclear bombs. Could the Islamic State make or get their hands on one and launch an attack in Europe?
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello, I'll be talking about Turkey's new efforts to try and destabilize Assad in Syria, and that is going through Lebanon.
Well, after the Brussels terrorist attack last Tuesday, investigations quickly revealed connections between the perpetrators of those attacks and the people who carried out the attacks in Paris last November. The picture that is emerging just in this last week is deeply disturbing. Every week, our writing staff puts together the Trumpet Weekly. This is a digest of important news articles from around the world over the week. And this week's edition is packed with information that emerged this week revealing that the Islamic State is more dangerous than has been realized. It has far deeper penetration into Europe than was previously thought. We have a lot to discuss here, and to lead off the discussion, we're going to turn to Richard.
Hi, yes, I'll just begin with an overview of some of the material that we have in the Trumpet Weekly, because there have been a whole ton of articles this week on this subject, and we've got some of the best, and they do make some startling points. Over the weekend, the Washington Post published an article where they wrote that a pan-European effort to crack the Islamic State network behind the Paris and Brussels attacks is yielding an unsettling discovery, a web of interlocking terror cells whose dimensions authorities say are still trying to grasp. So they're noting that this is a very significant, very sophisticated infiltration. Then The Guardian had an article published last Friday that I talked about at more length on the Trumpet Daily radio show this week, that they claim is based on information from two Islamic State members that say that Islamic State held a big meeting last year and launched a coordinated effort to send experienced members back to Europe to set up terror cells, to recruit more people, just to bring a level of professionalism into planning attacks in Europe, and really a shift in focus of the group from gaining territory in the Middle East to attacking European capitals and aiming to make societies crumble. Then Spiegel, they also had an article that was titled "Activating the Sleepers: Islamic State adopts a new strategy in Europe." And they wrote, "The people behind this terror are proving to be surprisingly far-sighted, patient planners, and not rash actors. This applies in both Syria and Europe. And they wrote, "This is the new and long underestimated side of Islamic State." And so they talked about how the Islamic State has in the past sent in agents long ahead of a planned attack or an assassination, had them stay in place for quite a significant amount of time, in some cases years, gain the trust of the people that they're planning on attacking. And they just talked about how Islamic State's behavior is in many ways more like that of a secret service than of animated fanatics. And they concluded that terrorism has become more professional than it was in the days of Al-Qaeda.
This is really just exactly the nightmare scenario that Europe was fearing. We've been talking a bit in weeks past about just how difficult it is to track these types of individuals if they don't have any kind of a record. This Spiegel article that's talking about these sleeper cells, these are individuals who specifically avoid detection, who don't emerge until the big event happens.
Right. And then they'll pick people who don't have any significant arrest record with the police. You know, a lot of times in recent attacks that we've seen, this is somebody the police have arrested and released. And then in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, they suddenly revisited a lot of these people that they already had on their database, already had on their radar. And so Islamic State is trying to get people in place a long time ahead of time that aren't on anybody's radar at all.
Yeah, the other item that you were going to mention.
Right. I thought the geopolitical futures, they had some similar points to Spiegel, but they made them just really powerfully. They talked about how, you know, Al-Qaeda was a terrorist organization, but Islamic State is a state. Not only do they have these radical recruits, but they have all of the advantages that comes from literally running a country as well, and the resources that come with that. And they've proven themselves very effective, you know, much more effective than Western analysts believed possible at the start of their rise. And so geopolitical futures, right, in the case of Islamic State, it is not the usual paramilitary group engaging in acts of terrorism. It is staging attacks in numerous countries from East Asia to the West, and at the same time controlling territory in the heart of the Middle East. It is a terrorist organization as well as a state. Most observers have yet to recognize that Islamic State has multi-divisional conventional military capability. And then it says, likewise, for Islamic State to be able to simultaneously execute terror attacks across the world while being hunted by a global dragnet means it has a very sophisticated intelligence apparatus. So we're looking at something that is both almost a country and terrorist organization, and that combination makes it very deadly.
Well, let's go ahead and bring Brent into the discussion. Another story in this week's Trumpet Weekly, this specifically reveals some of the targets that the Islamic State has in its sights. You want to tell us about that, Brent?
Yeah, sure. The Islamic State, they posted pictures on the internet this week calling on German Muslims to carry out similar attacks to what took place in Brussels, but inside Germany. And specifically, the two targets that they were shown in front of were Chancellor Angela Merkel's offices and also the Cologne-Bonn airport as their targets. So they had these images up and they had different slogans being chanted below them. In the case of one of the images, it talked about how we should be attacking the enemies of Allah. And then the one that was in front of the Bonn airport, it says, "What your brothers in Belgium were able to do, you can do too," thinking about the attack on the airport there as well. And then another one, a third graphic, featured a military jet, which German media did identify as a Tornado, ones that's being used by the German Air Force down in Syria right now in reconnaissance flights and such. And with that aircraft in the shot, there was a backdrop of mountainous area where civilians had been bloodied with women's faces and children looking like they had been attacked by German aircraft, which was obviously false. They're not having that type of mission just yet. But then the caption under that image says, "Will you continue to grieve or will you finally act?" So it's talking to Islamic State militants and or people, Muslims, that are already disgruntled inside Germany and saying, look what the Germans are doing to us. Are you ready to act in defense of Islam right now? And I think it's interesting just to look at the locations that they're choosing here has shifted towards Germany.
Right. They're really going after the most powerful country in Europe and the one that we've been talking about. As soon as we see Germany suffering from these kinds of attacks, suddenly this whole war enters a new level of seriousness.
Right. It's one of those things. What we've seen over the last couple of years particularly is that Europe can act together only and if Germany is at the helm, moving, banging heads together. We saw that in Greece. If Germany's in the leadership role, things can get done. And right now, at least with the fight against Islamic State or what's happening in Syria, Germany hasn't been too involved in that fight, and Europe's response has been weak because of that. Now, if they are successful, the Islamic State, in having an attack on a German target, that could really motivate German politicians, and especially the German public to demand something of their politicians to really unify Europe.
I'd like to pitch it back over to Richard, but before I do, just a couple of quotes that I want to draw attention to from this Trumpet Weekly. The headline underneath, another Islamic State image in front of the German Chancellery in Berlin. The picture shows the Chancellery on fire with an Islamic State fighter in a tank standing outside the structure with the headline, "Germany is a battlefield." And also a quote from the spokesman of Germany's federal police saying that it's clear that Germany is the focus of international terrorism and that attacks could happen. A lot of warnings that have been issued over the years. So far, it hasn't happened on the scale of what it looks like we could be seeing very soon. But a whole other dimension to this story that we have to talk about before we move on. Let's go ahead and bring it back over to Richard, just to conclude this discussion. Extremely troubling element that Stephen Fleury talked about on the Trumpet Daily radio show this morning, evidence that the Islamic State is specifically trying to gain control over nuclear weapons in Europe. Richard?
That's right. We've got a few different articles talking about this. First off, I'll focus on nuclear power stations, because we do have some very solid proof that Islamic State have at least thought about targeting nuclear power stations and may have already. So Islamic State, we know, had a top official at a nuclear power plant under surveillance. They found video footage of him in an Islamic State apartment. There were at least two people who used to work at a nuclear power station, traveled to Syria and joined the Islamic State. One of those men traveled back to Belgium, where he was arrested and then released. Then somebody sabotaged a nuclear reactor in Belgium in 2014 and got away with it. They drained 65,000 liters of oil. They caused so much damage that the reactor was shut down for 5 months. There was no radiation breach. But that's proof that it is possible to sabotage a Belgian nuclear power station in a very major way. This was at the same power station that the jihadists worked at. So they may have been behind it. They don't know. They haven't figured out who did it yet. And then finally, just one kind of piece of circumstantial evidence. But a couple of days after the Belgium attack, a security guard for one of these nuclear power stations was murdered. He was shot and his security badge was stolen. So that's a worrying news item. So we know for sure that the Islamic State was at least considering an attack, if not actively planning an attack on a Belgian power station. And we know that their security is vulnerable and has been breached in the past. So there's a lot of major concern there. And that has spread a lot of discussion. And we have a couple of articles on that in the Trumpet Weekly. And then what specifically Mr. Stephen Fleury spoke about this morning is even more worrying. And that is the nuclear weapons that America has stored in Belgium, then also in the Netherlands and in Germany and Turkey and other places. And there we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly, and this is something we've spoken about before, about just how dreadful security is at these facilities. The worst example being in 2010, protesters broke in there. They wandered around for around an hour before finally a single security guard with an unloaded gun apprehended them, and then they were let go. They didn't even bother taking their video footage. Then they broke in again. This time they got all the way to the shelters where the nuclear bombs were stored. They were there for a bit. They left. Nobody stopped them. Nobody caught them. And the first the Belgian authorities knew was when video of this was uploaded to YouTube. So the security there is absolutely atrocious. And this author brings out, they may have introduced a few measures since then to improve that security, but it shows that it's the mindset that's really important. And no matter how many check boxes you make security guards go through, if the base isn't taking security seriously, there's a major vulnerability there. And so there's a lot of very real worry about Islamic State and a potential nuclear attack.
Right. If there were people who were determined to actually take advantage of those security vulnerabilities, It wouldn't be difficult at all for them to do that. These vulnerabilities have been exposed, and certainly these determined foreign fighters, Islamic radicals, could really have their way.
That's right. And I think it's important to consider what we've said about nuclear bombs, about what we're talking about earlier, in the context of what we were talking about earlier about Islamic State's capabilities. You know, this is a group that a lot of experts are saying is more capable than Al-Qaeda was, that Europe is in more danger now than America was probably on September 12th and going forward after September 11th. They're not taking that danger anywhere near as seriously. And so you've got a very capable group that's actively planning a nuclear attack, and or at least considering a nuclear attack. And you know, attacking a nuclear power station would be very hard. Even if they'd managed to get one of these nuclear bombs from the Belgian base, they're supposedly locked so that they can only be fired or only detonate once the go-ahead has been given by America. So there would be still some difficulty in opening up and making that into a bomb. And so there will be some people saying, well, we don't really need to worry. But we need to remember how capable this group is, the state that they have behind them. If they get one of these nuclear bombs, they certainly do have the resources to open that up, to make that into an operational weapon. If they break into a nuclear power plant, they could certainly make a dirty bomb, if not an actual nuclear explosive. And I think the quote that best sums this up came from Professor Bunn of Harvard. And this is how the New York Times quoted him. They said that he noted that the Islamic State has an apocalyptic ideology and believes that there is going to be a final war with the United States. And they expect to win that war and would need very powerful weapons to do so. And if they ever did turn to nuclear weapons, he added, they have more people, more money, and more territory under their control and more ability to recruit experts globally than Al-Qaeda at its best ever had. So this is a serious threat. And I'll just conclude with what Mr. Flurry said about this a few years ago. And he wrote that September 11th made clear that there are madmen in this present evil world who will use whatever weapons at their disposal. We must realistically ask ourselves, how long until nuclear terrorism begins? Do we really understand the dangerous times in which we live? And this whole section in the Trumpet Weekly that talks about these attacks and the capabilities of Islamic State really drive that home.
Yeah, look at what the Islamic State has already done with very primitive weapons. It's just chilling to think about what they would do with nuclear capability. Well, thank you, gentlemen. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to leave the discussion of terrorism within Europe and talk about a different kind of security issue, specifically for Britain. An article in this week's Trumpet Weekly discusses a specific way that Britain is making itself vulnerable to foreign powers, not from the Middle East specifically, but more from Asia. For this story, we'll turn to Robert Morley.
Yeah, this story we'll talk about also has a nuclear aspect to it as well. Primarily what I'd like to talk about is just the fact that Britain is losing its steel industry, its ability to manufacture and produce steel, and some implications from that. But also the aspect to this that is related to that is the motivation for Britain giving up its industry. For a nation to purposefully let an industry as important as steel manufacturing go extinct or die, or at least be greatly reduced, there has to be some powerful motivation behind that. And as this article that I'll quote from in a minute that comes out of the Telegraph points out, part of that reasoning is because Britain needs help with its nuclear industry, and it needs desperate help, and that could be the trade-off it's making to give up its steel industry. So maybe I could just start by talking about some stats here. Britain at one time was the world's biggest producer of steel. It produced more steel than Germany, France, and Russia combined. Now, that was in the lead up to World War I. But ever since that time, every nation that has maintained global power status, world superpower status, or tier one status, has had a capability to manufacture steel. Steel is the metal of warfare. I mean, it has been ever since World War I. And that is something now that Britain is set to lose. It's already been losing a lot of its capability. And more recently, it's taken a nosedive in its production of steel. And that's because China has been flooding the British market with steel. And China is now the world's biggest producer of steel by far. Over half of the world's production steel production comes out of China. Just to give you some more context, China's excess capacity of steel, meaning the amount of steel it could be producing but it isn't because its factories are idled, is as much as the total production capability of Europe today. That's just the idled capacity coming out of China. So China is, it has become by far the world's leader in steel. And since the global economic slowdown, which began in 2008, 2009, and more particularly over the last 2 years, as trade has slowed down, global trade has slowed down, steel prices have plummeted. Iron ore prices have plummeted. And China is looking for every market it can find to keep its factories humming, its people employed. And it's been flooding the markets in Britain and in Europe.
Now, this is basically the reason why Britain says, well, why do we need to produce it when we can buy it so cheaply from China?
That's right. That is exactly what the leaders in Britain are telling their people, are telling. That's the argument they're making. They're saying this is free market economics at work. Well, yeah, we're losing the steel industry. We're losing some jobs there. But look at everything else in Britain and Europe that we're getting cheaper now. Cars are cheaper. Anything made out of steel is cheaper. So there's benefits on that side. And from a purely economic standpoint, free trade works. But the greater question here is, you know, what happens when you're dealing with a communist hostile nation, potentially, and you can't produce steel? You know, where are the limitations of free market capitalism? And that's, I think, the danger that Britain has opened itself up to.
Well, just one other point. I mean, it's not even free. What we're seeing isn't a free market. I think we also need to remember China has its artificially low currency. It's essentially subsidizing its steel, making it cheaper while it attempts to grab a share of that market. So it's cheating in that sense from the free market perspective. But Britain doesn't have the will to stand up to that and say, no, that's cheating. We're going to impose penalties.
Yeah, they really have to put blinders on to look at such a tiny part of the picture and to say, well, this is actually in our advantage to undertake this kind of a deal with China. But that they're not just looking at that, though. There are other reasons for what they're doing.
Right, absolutely. And Richard, you make a great point. I mean, China's steel industry is probably bankrupt, except the Chinese government keeps flooding it with money. They just bailed out their largest steel producer to the tune of $16 billion this last year. So, but as the point you're making, Mr. Hilliker, you're absolutely right. Britain is aware of these things. It's not like they don't understand what we're saying right here. There is a reason that they're doing this. And what analysts like Ambrose Evans-Pritchard has brought out in the Telegraph this last week in a piece he wrote, he said that this is a planned trade-off with China. This is a calculated trade-off with China. Basically, Britain's nuclear power industry needs major, major help. Britain has gone from the point where it was the world leader in nuclear power development and in power plant construction to the point where it can't do it on its own anymore today. Today it relies on other nations to build nuclear power plants. And this is exactly what's happening. The massive Hinkley power plant that's designed to go live, this is an $18 billion project. This is the biggest nuclear power plant, the biggest any type of power plant project in world history. This is being built in Britain. And Britain cannot do it, build this on its own anymore. It needs China and France to do it. And that just says so much about the state of technology in this world and where the cutting-edge technology is. And in this case, it's the French and the Chinese that are doing this. And Britain can't afford it, and it doesn't have the technology to do it. So it needs China to come in and provide this. And this, they are saying, is a trade-off, that China will build this plant, and China has committed the finances and resources to build two more going forward. And British leaders have looked at this, and this might be part of what Pritchard Evans called a Faustian pact.
You know, this story that we have in the Trumpet Weekly, very much worth reading and contrasting the path that Britain is taking with respect to its industry versus Germany and other European countries and just how much more farsighted some of the German leaders are in the way that they're dealing with China. But seeing this in the context of China's rise overall and Britain's fall, it's really a fascinating aspect of that story that we see ongoing. Well, thank you, Robert, for that. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. We've been talking about the rise in authoritarianism in China. And there's a really remarkable story this week showing an intensification of that trend. And for this, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, this story begins about a week ago when 16 Chinese citizens went mysteriously missing just after the news outlet that they all worked for published an anonymous letter calling for the resignation of Chinese President Xi Jinping. The BBC reported on March 25th that the outlet's senior manager, senior editor, and four other employees had been arrested by police, and also 10 other individuals who were employed in a related technology company were arrested. And the whereabouts of all 16 of them have been unknown ever since those arrests. So that was a frightening development, showing the, as you said, the increasingly authoritarian direction of Mr. Xi. But then on March 30th, just 2 days ago, this story became even more chilling. We've known for quite some time that Xi regularly seeks to silence its critics at home there in China. But on March 30th, reports emerged showing that he was reaching beyond China's borders to silence criticism. Two exiles living in Germany, these were Chinese exiles living in Germany, they said that Chinese authorities had abducted their relatives back in China as a means of applying pressure on them. So these two Chinese people there in Germany were apparently involved in the publication of that letter that called for Xi's resignation. So it's clear that these are connected to the original 16 detainees there. So it's a pretty sobering set of events happening, and it really sounds like the type of news you would have heard from the Soviet Union during the Cold War era. But this is something that the Trumpet has been keeping its eye on over the years. Back in December of 2013, just about a year after Xi had become China's president, we published a piece called Xi Jinping, an Aspiring Vladimir Putin, with a question mark on the end. It was written by Don Jacques, and this was early in Xi's presidency, but the piece pointed to some indications that were already evident, showing that his leadership style really pointed to the fact that he would probably shape up to be sort of the Vladimir Putin of China, a leader who rules with an iron fist and who does not tolerate dissent. One quote from that article says, "Xi's leadership style reflects what appears to be an agreement among many senior officials that they need a more agile and a more forceful leader to cope with difficult economic restructuring, foreign policy pressures, and domestic challenges." So that's basically just saying that since China was suffering some economic setbacks and other pressures at home, the upper echelons of the Communist Party wanted a man like Xi. They wanted someone willing to take charge and to make hard decisions to lead the country. And time has proven that Xi was exactly the man for the job. His increasingly dictatorial leadership is a trend that is really important for us to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I can't help but think back to the statement that New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman made, where he said, "I wish that the U.S. could just become like China just for a day so that we could have more of that authoritarian power concentrated at the top." I would not want to be a journalist in China.
No, me neither.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a threat to peace in the Pacific, Turkish activity in Lebanon, a politician who is regaining his popularity among the German people, and America's junk in the trunk economy. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Some interesting developments this week with Turkey, this extremely powerful NATO country right there in the neighborhood with Syria and other problem areas in the Middle East. To tell us about some of Turkey's recent activity that could have a real impact on the situation in Syria, we're going to go back to Brent Noctegal.
The piece that we have in the Trumpet Weekly today is from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. It's a think tank over here in this city. And a pretty important piece, I think, was written this week just describing how Turkey might be changing its tactics towards its fight against Assad in Syria. Now, we've known for a long time that Turkey has been against Assad's rule. Assad has killed a lot of Turkmen in northern Syria ever since the civil war started out. And Turkey's way of contributing to that fight against him, to get rid of him, was to train and to allow the free transit of soldiers or terrorists across their border into Syria to fight against the Assad regime. But ever since Russia has come in, it's kind of put a stop to that way that they were doing it before. And it looks like they're trying to tap into another front, or to create another front in the fight against Assad, and that is going through Lebanon. Lebanon, to this point, they've kept relatively free from violence, and it hasn't spilled over the border too much, this civil war, which is extremely surprising. Yet it looks like with Saudi Arabia's actions that we've talked about lately, and then now Turkey, it looks like that fight might open up.
So what's the strategy with Lebanon? Basically, they're dealing with this terrorist entity there in Lebanon that has really played a significant role in the fight in Syria.
Right. Hezbollah occupies the southern areas of Lebanon, and it's been the most effective ground force in supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria. A lot of their fighters have crossed the border straight into Syria to support Assad. Now, the northern part of the country of Lebanon, which actually borders Syria to the north, the province of Latakia, that is heavily Sunni-dominated. And what we had in late February was a shipment of six containers full of shipping containers full of arms and weaponry that was caught close to Greece by Crete, actually in the Mediterranean, sailing from Turkey under a Togo flag. And it was en route to Tripoli in northern Lebanon. And that was intended to go to Lebanese Sunni fighters that would then either confront Hezbollah inside Lebanon, or more importantly, go further north to squeeze the Assad-dominated region of western Syria. If you look at the map, you've got southern Turkey, which goes down on the west, on the eastern side of the Mediterranean, and then you also have a little patch of Syria right where Russia has its base in Tartus, and that's the province of Latakia, and then south of that you have Lebanon. So you've got the Shiite Alawite base there inside Syria between the pincers of southern Turkey and northern Lebanon. So it looks like Turkey is trying to mobilize those fighters there, and maybe even mobilize some of the million Sunni refugees that are inside Lebanon right now to bring the fight to Assad from the south.
Pull the Hezbollah fighters out of the theater in Syria, where they have to go back home and deal with business there.
Right. It would definitely cause Hezbollah to think more about protecting its power base inside Lebanon. And it would also, I think, threaten Assad's main area of support himself inside Syria if they decide to cross the border as well.
What prophetic implications does this have? The alliances that we're looking for from a prophetic standpoint, they're always very interesting to track, and particularly in recent months as all of this territory has been in play. How might this align with our expectations?
Right. We're looking for, because Bible prophecy dictates that this territory along the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean is not going to stay with the Iranian camp like it is right now. Yes, Hezbollah does dominate Lebanon, and Hezbollah is a puppet or a proxy of Iran, but it doesn't look like Lebanon is going to be beholden to Hezbollah and beholden to Iran for too much longer. And also, surprisingly, Syria, this region to the north as well, looks like Bible prophecy states that it is going to fall in alliance with Turkey, with Lebanon eventually, and with a coming in European power, of which there is some talk of Europe sending peacekeepers into this region. Another story that came across the news headlines this week.
Very interesting to watch. Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We started the program today by talking about the problems Europe is facing with terrorism. One of the most outspoken critics of the way Europe has handled Islamic extremism is a man we've been watching for some years as a possible major player in Europe's future. An interesting story we have in the Trumpet Weekly this week concerns this man. And to tell us about it, we will go to Richard Palmer.
The former defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, has considerable support for mounting a comeback. There was a Forsa poll published this week that found that 48% of those that responded would welcome his return, with only 30% against. Now, perhaps even more significant, of those people that support Gutenberg's return, 36% said that they see him as a candidate for the chancellorship. So overall, that would be about 17% of all respondents would view zu Guttenberg as a candidate for German chancellor. And they write that in this article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly from Die Welt, that publisher and advisor Gertrud Huller also does not consider this outlandish. And then they quote him saying, Angela Merkel is still in office because there is no decent successor in the CDU. Maybe the union should consider whether the CSU is the next candidate for chancellor. So even the fact that this poll was taken at all, I think, is revealing. It shows that there are major news organizations thinking that this, you know, asking the question, could zu Guttenberg be a candidate for chancellor?
Yeah, he's never said that he would do it. He's not the one who's putting his name out there.
Right. No, in fact, I really enjoyed it. Handelsblatt had an article, an interview with zu Guttenberg that they published in English this week, and I really enjoyed his response when they tried to put this question to him. They said, are you expecting any phone calls from Bavaria? You know, implying a return to German politics. And he said, maybe from someone inviting me to a soccer game? I would love to attend. So he's been quite
so
modest.
So coy.
Yeah, exactly.
This whole hard-to-get posture that he had. Well, it's interesting, too. We were talking just a few weeks back about that Financial Times article where the journalist was just put the question to him, you know, how much pressure are you getting these days? And he said, yeah, quite a lot. There's quite a lot of people who are knocking on my door and who are making comments in my ear and trying to encourage me to do this. But he still gives no indication that he's interested.
True, though, it's important to remember he's still got his toe in the water. He's still he's on that foreign policy advisory team for Horst Seehofer or advisory team for the next election. And he's advising on foreign policy. He's reportedly been invited to travel and meet Vladimir Putin alongside Horst Seehofer. And for that advisory role, there are some fairly senior people who weren't put into that role. And so the fact that he was raised a few eyebrows. So he's not come back, and he's definitely avoided coming back in a high-profile way. But he has connections, and he may well be already testing the water on that.
You also have to wonder if comments that he's making like those on immigration and the terrorist threat and the threat of Islamic extremism isn't going to increase his popularity over time. And he's been out there in the front warning about potential terrorist attacks in Germany, really criticizing German leaders for being behind in confronting this threat. So yet another area where he really seems to be out in front of the eight ball.
Right. In some ways, his big claim to fame as the in charge of the Defense Department was that he was the one that called the war in Afghanistan a war. And other German leaders before him had tried to kind of maintain this fiction that it was some kind of military operation, but fell short of being a war. So he certainly has that long track record of telling it like it is, of taking the threat of Islamic terrorism seriously, and then wanting to devote the resources necessary to confront it. So as going back to what Brent talked about right at the start of the program, if we see this become more of a threat and more of a threat specifically to Germany, you could certainly see more attention being paid to zu Guttenberg.
Well, thank you, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to go back to Asia for our next story. For some time, Japan has been expressing concern over China's rise and a desire to revise the pacifist constitution that America created after World War II so it can defend itself, especially as America withdraws from the region. There were some developments on this front over the past week, and to tell us about it, we will go to Jeremiah.
Yes, on Tuesday, a set of security laws went into effect in Japan, which historically switched Japan back to a fighting stance for the first time in 7 decades. So these laws reinterpret the pacifist part of Japan's constitution, which America wrote for the Japanese in the aftermath of World War II. And they basically say that as of Tuesday, Japanese troops could fight on foreign soil for the first time since the end of that war. Japan now has a right to engage in what's called collective self-defense. That means they could come to the aid of the United States or their other allies in the event of a conflict. The Japanese military could rescue Japanese hostages in other countries, and there's a whole host of other implications that come with these laws. So it's a really important trend, which the Trumpet has been keeping a close eye on for quite a while, and we are not the only ones watching Japan's march back toward militarism with a wary eye. After the law was enacted this week, Japan's neighbor to the west, China, published a scathing condemnation of the move. It was written in a commentary in the state-run Xinhua News Agency, which is a mouthpiece for the Chinese government. And I'll just read a few excerpts from this article. First of all, the title says, "Japan's security laws push the Asia-Pacific region into the abyss of instability." So they're really worried that this has the potential to destabilize the whole region. One excerpt here says, "By reinterpreting the country's war-renouncing constitution, the warlord prime minister shook off the restraints of Article 9 of the Supreme Law. The security laws will only serve to endanger the Japanese public's right to live in peace, and more importantly, pose a severe challenge to peace in the Asia-Pacific region, which is already vulnerable." And then this Chinese article ends with a pretty chilling statement. It says, "Looking back through history, the current chapter being manipulated by the Japanese prime minister has a German version in the 1930s when the Weimar Constitution was trampled on and Nazi Germany ruthlessly stormed Europe thereafter. Imperial Japan at that time occupied the Korean Peninsula and northeast part of China and prepared for widening its aggressive onslaught to the Asia-Pacific region. Let the future annals of Japanese history not read that it was foolish enough to allow history to repeat itself." So China's criticism there is somewhat hypocritical, given China's own military rise. But China remembers Japan's brutality before and during World War II, and it really fears a repetition of that.
That's really fascinating perspective coming from China about what Japan is doing. And you put it in the context of everything else that China is up to lately, and even the story from earlier in the program about just how heavy-handed it is against its own critics. You can see that it is not one to be messed with. It'll be interesting to watch this relationship between China and Japan develop. Obviously, we would expect that at some point they're going to reconcile, but certainly a whole lot of bad blood between those two nations today. Well, thanks for that story, Jeremiah. We're going to conclude with an economic story. This past week, Standard & Poor's credit rating agency issued an average rating on corporate debt in the U.S. That was at a near 15-year low. What does this mean for America's economy? Well, there's one man who can best answer that question for us, and that's Robert Morley.
Yeah, Standard & Poor's really had a very, very downbeat assessment of the U.S. economy and some implications for the economy based off of corporate America, health of America's companies. And with their recent report, they came out and said that the average credit rating for an American company had just reached a 15-year low, meaning the ability for America's companies to pay the debt that they have on average is the weakest in at least 15 years. That means this is today, corporate America is ranked lower, rated lower than it was during the depth of the crisis in 2008 and 2009. So this is pretty startling considering we're in a time period that all our leaders, the Janet Yellens of the world, tell us that we're in a recovery. We're in recovery mode. The economy's strengthening, or at least that was the assessment. And here Standard & Poor's is telling us the opposite. In fact, they said that since 2012, more than 75% of the companies who have gone to the market to borrow money were given a junk rating. So that's a rating of B, B B+, B-. And just to give you an idea of what this means, if you're a company and a company you're looking at a company that has a B- rating, Standard & Poor's says that company has a 1 in 10 chance of not making it through the year, of defaulting and going bankrupt before the year is out. And they said 75% of companies since 2012 have been borrowing money are these junk rated companies, and the odds of default just go up after that first year, even if they make it through that first year. And I find this really, really interesting, because if you take a look at our stock markets today, they're just shrugging it off. Our stock markets are at recent highs. And the question is, you know, where's the disconnect on this? And I found very interesting what Janet Yellen had to say on Tuesday. She gave a speech, and in that speech, she said that the economic outlook for America had actually deteriorated from her last speech. And what did the markets do when she came out and said the economic situation is actually worse than we thought it was? Well, the markets that opened up that day, the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, all these markets, they were in the red. Janet Yellen gives her speech saying things are worse than we thought, and suddenly they started rallying, and throughout the rest of the day, they rose and rose and rose. They ended up the day into the green, well into the green. So people looking at this would be thinking, what is going on? Things are worse than we thought, and yet the markets are going up. Our companies are becoming more valuable. Well, the reason this is all happening, and this really gets back to what S&P were warning, Standard & Poor's were warning about in this report, is that the markets are geared on debt. And when Janet Yellen comes out and says things are worse than normal, everybody knows that means the Federal Reserve is going to be more accommodative with their lending policies. They're going to push more debt into the system. They're going to do more quantitative easing. And poof, that makes it much easier for these companies to get more money and for the debt games to continue, and stocks go up. Is America better off? Is it more healthy? No. Are these companies more leveraged to debt? Yes. Are they more precarious? Yes. But there's more debt, so the games can go on for a little while longer.
Well, I just want to congratulate you on clearly explaining this highly illogical situation. Robert actually has an article on thetrumpet.com this week called America's Junk in the Trunk Economy on this very subject. It appears in this week's Trumpet Weekly. If you want to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, go to thetrumpet.com. All the stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we will start with Richard.
It's been big news on Britain's current account deficit. The current account shows how much the nation is exporting compared to what it is importing. And Britain is importing so much and exporting so little that its current account deficit is 7% of its economy, its entire economic output. That is the worst peacetime deficit since records began in 1772. It's the worst of any industrial country. The US is in second place, but still in quite a bit of better shape than the UK. So we heard earlier about how Britain is not making, or getting to the point that it's not making steel anymore. Well, really, it's not making much of anything anymore.
All right, we'll go now to Robert.
Evidence is rolling in that all the anti-police rhetoric following the Baltimore riots are resulting in more inner city violence, not less, as police have backed off for fear of being called racist. Violence is off the charts in Chicago. The city is off to its deadliest start in nearly two decades, the Tribune reported this past week. The city's on course to top 500 homicides for the year. Homicides are up 71% over last year. Last year, they were up double digits over the year before. Shootings are up. 727 people have been shot in Chicago so far this year. That's a 73% rise. In case you think that we only report the bad news, there were some hopeful numbers, signs in the numbers, and that is that homicides citywide rose by a more modest 25% from the year earlier. So there you have it. Chicago is so broken that a 25% increase in homicides is the good news.
Thank you for that, Robert. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
Vladimir Putin's Syria campaign served as a very effective advertisement for Russian weapons. This is something Brent has discussed before, but now we have some concrete dollar amounts to tack on to this development. Kommersant newspaper there in Russia reported on Monday that the marketing effect from Russia's Syria campaign could lead to contracts worth up to $7 billion. It looks like Algeria, Indonesia, Vietnam, Pakistan, and others are preparing to buy more Russian weapons because they were so impressed by the performance of those weapons in the Syria campaign there. And in the case of Pakistan, this is particularly interesting because Pakistan used to buy most of its weaponry from the USA. So now it looks like that business is going to be switching to Russia.
All right, back over to Richard.
There's more evidence of the explosive situation in Belgium this week. Belgium's vice prime minister said on Wednesday that celebrations broke out in the streets in several places after the Brussels attack. So people were celebrating, Muslims were celebrating an attack on their own country. On the other side of the coin, on Sunday, 340 hooligans and far-right supporters tried to disrupt a peaceful protest in central Brussels for victims of last week's attack, and the police were forced to use water cannon against these protesters. There was some evidence that they were quite violent. So you're getting more evidence of the widespread sympathy with radical Islam, and at the same time, the explosive mixture of then far-right supporters as well.
All right, let's pitch it over to Brent.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said on Wednesday that his country needs its controversial missile program in order to negotiate from a position of strength. And he also said that those that want to get rid of the rocket program from his own country are treasonous. Now, he kind of has a point here. If he gives up on his ballistic missile program, then he would not be negotiating from a position of strength. So he's going to hold on to them, regardless of what the world wants Iran to do.
And now to Robert.
This week, Mr. Obama hosted his nuclear summit. This is that summit that works towards eliminating nuclear weapons. It works towards nuclear weapon reduction. And what made this meeting so interesting is that Russia, Iran, and North Korea, some of the world's most prominent nuclear powers, refused to attend. So they weren't there at all. And I think it's just very symptomatic of the direction this world is heading with regards to these weapons of mass destruction. We see Iran violating its nuclear agreements several times, no consequences. The Islamic State saying it's plotting to obtain nuclear weapons and nuclear material. And here we have the keynote summit for reduction in nuclear weaponry, and some of the biggest sponsors of nuclear proliferation weren't even there.
All right, another quick one from Richard.
The German Interior Minister proposed a new law this week that would require refugees to integrate into society or lose their right of residence. They'd have to learn German and be seeking work within 3 years of arriving, or they'd be deported. So that's a shift in the direction of cracking down on migration. The alternative for Deutschland, the more fringe party, they want to go even further. The Bavarian branch produced a paper, or the Bavarian branch, calling for all mosques to be banned and closed down. The leadership disowned that paper. It's a bit too extreme even for the AfD, but it certainly shows some appetite within Germany to counter radical Islam.
All right, one final item to Jeremiah.
Russians are now drinking less and living longer. The people of Russia have long been viewed by Westerners as hard drinkers who live difficult lives and often die before their time. But an article published in Russia Beyond the Headlines says that these trends are now reversing. Life expectancy has increased to just over 71.2 years. Maternal mortality has also dropped by over 11%, and the mortality rate among the working age population has dramatically decreased as well. And experts say that this is due mostly to healthy lifestyle changes, including a decrease in smoking and alcohol consumption. I've not found a whole lot of analysis about this, but I believe it could be related in part to Russia's resurgence as a global power. The Russians love what Putin has done in Georgia, Ukraine, and most recently in Syria, just reclaiming great power status for Russia. Studies show that happiness levels among Russians are soaring over the last decade. And it looks like that is causing them to engage in fewer self-destructive behaviors and to live longer.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. The stories we talk about on the program are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Pablo Picasso. Only put off until tomorrow what you are willing to die having left undone. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.